Hi, welcome to another edition of the 19th Hole Golf Show. I'm Ryan Balogi. It's great to have you here with us. It has been a while. I've been away for about a month, and when I haven't been away, I've been working on stuff, and when I haven't been working on stuff, I've been away. So it's really nice to be able to sit down and record a podcast again. So it's a pleasure to be able to talk to you for a little while. You can get a hold of me on Twitter at Ryan Balogi, RyanBalenGee, and you can reach me and find all of my work through GolfNewsNet.com, through all of our social media platforms, on your favorite service at the handle GolfNewsNet. I'm on Instagram at Ryan Balogi now, occasionally posting stuff that really has nothing to do with golf, just about me personally. But if you care about that kind of thing, you're welcome to stop by. And you can also follow us on our apps for Amazon Fire TV and Roku TV. So, we have a new sponsor for you. We'll tell you about the halfway point, but I'm very excited to have them on board this year. And then we still have our sponsorship with Auto Slash for a couple of more shows. So at the halfway point, we'll do a couple of reads and fill you in on the good news on the new sponsorship. But in the meantime, obviously, it's kind of been a while since I've done one of these. I've been all over the place. And by all over the place, I mean two very specific places. I was in Puerto Rico for a few days as part of a trip, what's called a FAM trip, a media familiarization trip. Put on by Discover Puerto Rico, and they had me play a number of courses around the island, which was incredible. We'll talk about that in a minute, and then also play in the Pro-Am for the Puerto Rico Open. And then I came home for a few days and went down to Orlando with my father-in-law, and we had our annual family and friends Greensburg Cup. We'll talk about that too very briefly. And then I stayed around for another week. My parents came down. My wife and our two kids came down, her two sisters came, her mother-in-law came. So there was a group of 10 of us at Walt Disney World for a week. So that's while at the same time Jason Day was apparently there. So a lot of things going on. A lot happened in the last few weeks. And I spent last week just trying to not decompress, although you kind of have to do that as part of a Disney vacation. And I totally had forgotten about that in the 10 years since I had last gone to Disney World. But you also, in my position, have to kind of recover a little bit by getting some work done, just knocking some things off the list. So last week I didn't really have much time or energy to be able to do a podcast, and I just wanted to make sure that when I came back and sat down behind the mic, I was, you know, reasonably up to date on things, and I'm pretty close to that. And so here we are. So I figured I'd spend a few minutes talking about what the hell's been going on the last couple of weeks in my travels, but also talk about the Players' Championship in the second half of the show, which was fantastic in every way imaginable. So, Puerto Rico. So this trip kind of came about rather suddenly, actually, at the tail end of January, I believe. And a buddy of mine, Dan Shepard, who runs a public relations firm, and known him for a number of years, reached out and said, hey, would you like to go to Puerto Rico? I've got a spot open in a FAM. You can play in a PGA Tour Pro-Am, be on the island for a few days, play some other golf. It'll be great. Yeah, sounds wonderful. I would love to do that. Never played in a PGA Tour Pro-Am. I've played in others. I played last year, if you remember, in a Symetra Tour Pro-Am. I'm going to hopefully play in that again this year over at French Lick in Indiana for the Sweeney Cup, the second annual Sweeney Cup. Very excited about that possibility. I played one on the Champions Tour back in 2011 with Mark Wiebe, who is still to date one of the coolest people I've ever met, one of the great guys I've met in golf. And then I haven't done a PGA Tour Pro-Am, and I haven't done an LPGA Pro-Am, and I haven't done a Nationwide Pro-Am, Web.com Tour Pro-Am. All those things are fine, but the PGA Tour Pro-Am concepts sound really cool. I mean, you never know who you're going to play with. They don't tell you till the Tuesday before, and they have a pairings party for all of that. And on top of all that, I get to go to Puerto Rico and play golf. And I've wanted to go to Puerto Rico for a long time. My wife and I considered going there for our honeymoon, which will almost be 10, it'll be 9 years in May. We chose Mexico instead. We went to Playa del Carmen area, Tulum, that part of it. And after Hurricane Maria and all that went through with that, the humanitarian crisis, all the damage to the island, the poor response from the federal government, just all the pieces of it, I wanted to go there. I just wanted to see it as it was recovering. I wanted to see it just from a human perspective, not necessarily even from a golf perspective. I would have been willing to go just to go. And so I jumped on the chance, and flew in Tuesday night of tournament week. So I wasn't there for the pairings party. It's basically just an excuse to get together with whoever you're going to play with and drink with the amateurs while the pros show up for like 6 seconds, and then they've got stuff to do. And so I got on the ground, got my flight, landed on the ground at the airport in San Jose, or San Juan, sorry, San Jose is in Costa Rica, in San Juan, and texted Dan. I was like, hey, who do we get? And he said, Josh Teeter. And Josh Teeter is a 39-year-old guy from Kentucky. He's been on the PGA Tour for what feels like 10 or 15 years. Been around. He's a survivor. He's a really good player. And I knew that the PGA Tour had moved to a 9-and-9 structure. So the pro-ams are 18 holes, and you tee off one, and then you just kind of go in a circle. I mean, you play an 18-hole round with your professional. But now they don't do that anymore. They do. You play the first 9 holes with one professional. They drop you off to the 10th tee with another professional waiting, and you play the back 9 with them. So that way, the pro only has to commit maybe 3 hours, 4 hours of their day to playing what is essentially a 9-hole practice round with you, and then they can go on and do their thing. And if you're in the afternoon wave or in the afternoon portion or however it works, you know, basically 4 shifts, morning 1, morning 2, afternoon 1, afternoon 2, basically you can kind of schedule your day around that. So if you need to get real practice in, you can do that. If you really don't need to do anything like that on Wednesday, although I don't imagine you would, then you can rest up however you need around that schedule. It works out really, really well. So we get to the first tee after a really nice breakfast, and we meet the guy who's going to be our pro for the first 9. That's Martin Piller. And I met Martin last year at the Houston Open when I went down to visit Steve Elkington in his hometown. Had a really good time with Elk and meeting Martin, who at the time was getting ready to become a dad for the first time with his wife, Drina Piller, who is an LPGA superstar in her own right. And so I talked to Martin, like, hey, how's father life, and all that good stuff, kind of catching up on being a father, because I feel like that gives you a pretty immediate bond to somebody. I mean, I know it's kind of cursory, but if you're there, if you've been in that, and a lot of people have, obviously, at this point in my life, or just really starting to get into it, then it's just a great conversation starter. So anyway, we talked about that for a while. Our team played great in the front 9. Everyone kind of got involved. Our team for the day was Jason Lusk, who is an editor and writer for Golf Week, and I played with him a couple weeks prior, or been in the same place as him a couple weeks prior at Stream Song, the couple days before the PGA Merchandise Show. We played Stream Song Black on the day when it was, 35-mile-per-hour winds throughout the day, and it was just absolutely crazy. We didn't play in the same group. We talked about it all. Had an overnight stay. It was very lovely. And he's a guy I really easily get along with. And played with Alexandra Lachlan from Golf Channel. And she does a lot of social media video for them. She does a bunch of web video and some stuff that appears on Golf Channel itself, Golf Central. She does Golf Advisor videos. She plays on a lot of these types of pro-ams. She just kind of deals with this type of stuff a lot. So she could not have seemed more disinterested by what was going on. But getting to see a cool place, I guess, was what brought her into it. And then our third was John Paul from Discover Puerto Rico, who was absolutely nice, whole lot of fun to play with, and we got along really, really well. And so that was our 4, and then we had Martin for the first 9. So Jason drills this like 40-footer. Jason's a really, really good player. I mean, he's probably, a 2 or 3. I forget what he told me he was, but he's scratch caliber. And so he drains this huge putt on the first hole. Second hole, Mart makes a birdie. Third hole, I make a birdie. Fourth hole, Alex makes a birdie. Fifth hole, I got us home in 2 and set up a birdie. Sixth hole was the one we parred. 7 and 8, we didn't birdie the par 3s, which is kind of weak. But anyhow, 7, I nearly drove the green and then got up and down, made my own birdie. And then 9, we're 6 under, and we're like, all right, well, we got to kind of step on it a little bit before the back. And we had some pretty weak shots to be absolutely blunt. The 9th holes is a little short dogleg par 4, not very long. None of us did anything all that great. But it was, you know, one of us would probably make something. And Martin lands in the greenside bunker. Mind you, he's playing like 100 yards back from us on most holes on the par 4s. Because this is like a 7,400-yard golf course for the pros, 7,500 yards, Cocoa Beach. And so he hits his second shot into the greenside bunker. And while we're getting ready to get our putters and start looking at putts and start thinking about making one, he just jars his bunker shot for birdie. And, well, we're done here. So it was a really awkward, kind of abrupt send-off. But we were 7-under at the turn. Again, Martin was great. The weird thing about this golf course, this type of pro-am, was that unlike the Symetra Tour pro-am, we didn't play tees remotely close to each other. The Symetra Tour pro-am on a golf course designed by Donald Ross not too long after the turn of the century, there wasn't a whole lot of distance between the professional tees and between ours. So it wasn't really that big of a deal to have, in that case, Elizabeth Zokel tee off, like walk 10 steps and be right near us again. In this case, it was kind of awkward because Martin would go back 60, 70, 100 yards to go tee off, and then we would be standing on the box ready to go, pound away, and by the time he was up to us, it was over. We were in carts and moving. So there wasn't a whole lot of time for talking just because we kind of kept on going. Anyhow, so we make the turn. It was great to spend a couple hours with Martin Piller. I would love to do it again. And he was saying how Jarena Piller was getting ready to kind of start her LPGA career again, and the absolute madness that is the first time you are in charge of your child all by yourself. It really is a harrowing experience when you do it for more than like 3 hours. Like when they're a baby, obviously when they're sleeping, they're not doing a whole lot other than sleeping, feeding, pooping, and peeing. That's pretty easy. But once they're about 7 or 8 or 9 months old and they're starting to become a real human being and they can kind of crawl around a little bit, and they're starting to move, and they can get into stuff. The prospect of being alone with that child overnight, much less for a week, basically, is scary. So I hope it went great for Martin, but I didn't get that feedback yet. And so we get to 10, and the thing I realize is we're getting to the 10th tee, and then see a cooler. Okay, well, I do need a drink. I'm a little thirsty. And there's beer in there. And Medalla is like the beer of Puerto Rico. I mean, they've got a bunch of good local breweries that's really starting to take shape, and the stuff's excellent. But Medalla is like the Coors Light, the Miller Light, Bud Light of Puerto Rico. And I was having several the night before. But I didn't know that they were in all of the coolers. And so by the time we get to the 10th tee, I feel like a total idiot because I haven't had any kind of drink yet. I mean, not even really water. And so I kind of made up for that a little bit in the back, had some beers. And it was starting to get sunny. It was starting to get a little bit warm. And the wind was picking up a little bit. And that's where we meet Josh Teeter. Josh was great. Josh and his caddy Lee were super fun. They kind of bantered with us enough. I mean, as much as you can. Again, being so far behind us on every hole because we're just pounding drivers on a shamble. And Alex can hit it pretty well. I mean, she hits it probably 230. You know, when she hits it really well, 240. And I'm hitting good drives throughout the round that are going 320, 330. So it's not like that distance between Josh and I is really getting any different. Like, it's always about 100 yards until we get to the green, and then all of a sudden we either make a putt real quickly or don't, but the holes kind of flew by quick. There wasn't really a team atmosphere to it. I guess that was the one thing I didn't like about it, but was just awkward about it, because you get to this point, and you're like, okay, I guess we're talking now. Like, all right, we'll see you in a while. We're going to go hit some shots. It's just very awkward. It really is. So anyway, we get through 15 holes, and we realize we've probably got to at least birdie in to have a chance. We get to 16. Jason makes this like 15-foot sidewinder that after Josh hits a beautiful tee shot, he doesn't even get to look at his own putt. Jason sees it right away, just throws it down, makes the damn thing, which is impressive. And we get to 17, which is semi-drivable from the tees that we were at. And John Paul hits a great one. I mean, JP just put one right up in front of the green. Alex actually went deep because she had an even further advantage, and she had a 25-mile-per-hour wind to help her. So she crushed one and went in the back bunker. So we get up and down quickly, and it starts to rain. Like, it's Puerto Rico is really interesting in that regard, and JP was telling us this, that there are kind of 3 or 4 different types of rain daily in Puerto Rico. There's one that's like 2 minutes, and it's really hard, and then it's over. Then there's kind of like the sort of spit that they've got, and then they've got just your classic kind of tropical monsoon style rain. They don't really have like rain like we have here in DC. A little bit different. All kinds of different types. And so we all rush over to this kind of Port-a-John farm under a tent and hang out there for maybe 10 or 15 minutes. And our walking scorer tells us, hey, the best score to come in, you basically have to make an albatross to win. And we're going to play a par 5 to finish, so that's actually possible. Even though it's not really. And we get on the tee, and for Josh, this is a 600-yard par 5 to close. Now, it's playing downwind, so that's good for him, or for any pro. And it makes it sort of reachable because of that. But Teeter smokes a drive. It's beautiful. It's got to be out there. 315, 320, 330, somewhere in there. He's going to have an iron in. And we move up about 100 yards, and I have, again, about 500 instead of 600. And I just crush one over a corner and leave about 150 in, 160 in with a flyer. So we're at 9 irons and 8 irons into the hole, thinking we got to make it to have a chance. And none of us even hit the green. It was so embarrassing. I hit a pretty good one, and I just landed a little left. That wasn't that bad. I mean, the shots weren't bad. We just kind of missed. And we made birdie, and it was fine. We finished T6 in the end. But Teeter was pretty funny going up 18. After he hits and starts walking up and realizes where we are and where we're hitting from, and after we all hit, he goes, why didn't you hit back? Why didn't you tee off from where I teed off from? Meaning, why didn't you play the hole from 600 yards? I said, well, because I get to hit a 9-iron into the green, and you got to hit a 4-iron into the green. And he kind of smiled and nodded about that. But it was really fun to play in a PGA Tour Pro-Am. And the great thing was, even though we had literally a 4:30 a.m. wake-up call so that we could get there in time, get warmed up, have breakfast, all of that stuff, even though all of that, about 15 minutes after we finished the round, it opened up for like 2 straight hours. I mean, we just sat under the veranda in the clubhouse just thinking, when is this going to stop and when can we go home? And eventually, I mean, it was fine. Eventually we did and had a wonderful trip. Otherwise, we played 2 incredible rounds at TPC Dorado Beach, which is a little bit different out of the way in the town of Dorado. We're doing a story on it for Golf Trip X. Just an incredible place. And then the next day, the final round, we played Rio Mar Country Club, which is part of kind of the Wyndham property over in a slightly different part of the island. And just some incredible views there. And played with this guy, Niels, who's the general manager of the property, a former World Cup downhill ski jumper, like one of the best in the world. And so he was absolutely fun to talk to. Well, again, all this stuff will be on golftripx.com. But it was really cool to be able to see Puerto Rico. I think of Puerto Rico, I think a bunch of American cities combined, really. Like, in some places it felt like Boston. In some places it felt like Miami. In other places it felt, obviously, absolutely Puerto Rico. Absolutely San Juan. But it was beautiful. Even the parts of town that were kind of still in recovery mode, and there weren't many. Maybe one or two places that I saw that were kind of in recovery mode. The most extreme out places in San Juan, like the old part of town. But it was incredible. I mean, just the food was, the restaurants that we went to, the food was unbelievable. The beer was good. There's gambling. You can be 19 and gamble in Puerto Rico. So we hit up the casino a couple times and had a good time there. There were bunches of them, and you could hit any of them. They're not big. Yeah, they're small-sized casinos, but they are casinos. The water views are incredible. I mean, just everything about it. I really like it there. And I think for a lot of people, they don't think about Puerto Rico as a destination, probably for a variety of reasons. Probably one, because it's not as cheap as a place like the Dominican Republic or Mexico or Jamaica, places like that, even Turks and Caicos to some extent, because all of those places are their own countries. They have labor laws that are much different than the United States. You can basically have cheap labor and pass the savings on to you, the consumer, and by having that cheap labor, then they can also make it all you can eat, all you can drink, all inclusive, and include some golf in that, and it is an incredible bargain. And it's not quite the same in Puerto Rico. I mean, there are places like that, don't get me wrong, but it's a little bit more like going to it is an American destination. So you have labor laws, you have a little bit more cost built in, you have better infrastructure, you've got a lot of better other stuff that maybe you don't notice if you just go to a resort and stay behind the gates and don't move, but you do have to pay for that, and that does come into it. But there's so much culture. The people are so nice. And the interesting thing to me, and I'll include this in the story too, the people that were on the Discover Puerto Rico team, two of them that I worked with throughout the entire week, they had moved to the mainland for one reason or another, whether they had moved there earlier in their career or for whatever reason. It didn't have anything to do with Maria. But they came back to Puerto Rico because they wanted to do something to help their homeland. And so they joined this team using their expertise to try to make people more aware of how great a place Puerto Rico is. And then you had Davilin, who was awesome. And she's probably, what, 24, 25, I would guess. And this is really her first big job out of school. And she's trying to do something to make her home a better place, get more people aware of what's going on. So that they put so much effort and love into that storytelling, I think really kind of shines through. And it also rubs off on the folks from the mainland, the golf professionals, many of them which came not only either after Maria, but many of them came before and stayed. And they wanted to make sure that they got their places of business, their presentation to the world, so to speak, back up and running, what it needed to be, so that they could make it healthy again. And so there's a lot going on there. It's going to be a long story, but I had an absolute blast down there. And I can't wait to go back. I will go back. I'll go back and not play golf. I would love to just go back and hang out and spend time in San Juan again. Go to El Yunque, which is the national forest there, which has amazing waterfalls and trails and other things. I'd like to go check out Dorado some more. I mean, just so much to check out that I have to go back someday. I got to go back. I won the Greensburg Cup again for the fourth time, which I feel very lucky to have won. We have basically 6 9-hole matches over 3 rounds. And then we've got two other rounds where we just kind of have some fun with it. And I've never played that well in terms of points in this thing. And, you know, you get 60 points maximum, right? So you get one for every hole, and you get one for winning the match. I think I had like 43 or 42 points over the course of the 6 9-hole matches. And I did not expect to win. I mean, honestly, I win the thing every 3 years. And usually there's kind of a little scam involved where you kind of have to position your hand. You have to have a couple bad years to get strokes back. I don't mean intentionally bad years. You just got to play badly to get strokes back so that you get in a position so that you can win. And I got lucky this year, and it all worked out. But next year, I went from a 6, I somehow get 6 strokes because it's all based off of how you play in the Greensburg Cup, to a 3. And if I have another good year next year, it's going to be like 0. So my chances of winning are kind of going to go down the tubes here for the next couple of years. But it's really cool. I mean, it's just, if you have one of these types of trips that you've been on, you know what I'm talking about, right? You know what it means to be able to get together either with your friends or family, whatever, however you know them. And you get to do it year after year. And now this is the 10th year I've done it. Or 11th year, excuse me, that I've done it. And so it just brings a smile. I mean, every couple of weeks I'm going to think, oh, it's only like 40 weeks until the Greensburg Cup again. And it happens upon us so quickly. But it's just such a great few days to be able to just get up in the morning, go play golf. Don't think about anything. Just don't think about your job. Don't think about how the world is. Don't think about any of the pressures of anything. Just have fun and enjoy each other's company. And I wish more people could do that. And I wish more people could do it more frequently. I wish I could do it more frequently. That. Don't get me wrong. I love going on FAMs. I love playing new courses. I love doing media event type stuff. But the Greensburg Cup is my favorite version of golf, where you get to have a competition. You get to play with some of your favorite people. And there's no thing hinging on it. There's no piece of media. There's no Instagram post. There's nothing that hinges on it. It's just pure enjoyment of golf, each other's company, incredible food. We cook ourselves some of the best steaks I've ever had, some of the best Italian food I've ever had. It happens on this trip. And so I always look forward to it every year, and I can't wait. I mean, it's already been almost 3 weeks since it happened. So we're basically 49 weeks away from doing it all over again, but I digress. So we're at the halfway point of the show. So first I want to tell you about our new sponsor this year. I'm really excited to work with ShotScope. ShotScope makes a product that is fundamentally a golf performance tracking platform. I'm actually looking at it, holding my hand right now. And so the really cool thing I like about ShotScope, other than that some of the people involved were literally high-level amateurs that good to play in the freaking Walker Cup for GB&I. Beyond that, what I love about ShotScope is that I've worked with other performance tracking platforms in the past. Obviously, there are kind of three at this point, and I've used others even beyond that for small projects, TaylorMade's with Microsoft Band. I've used others too. The thing that I've always kind of had a problem with in using those other platforms is that you either had to tag something, you had to hold something to tag it. So for years with Game Golf, now it's starting to change. But with Game Golf, you had to tag something to your belt. So you would take the sensor and you'd tag it to a thing that laid on your belt, and that would mess up your pre-shot routine. So you had to change the way you literally played golf for it to work, and even then it didn't do a great job of capturing the data. With Arcos, which is also a very good platform, you had to have an app that was running, and you had to have it near you or in your pocket at all times. So you were draining your battery. So if your phone was older than like 6 months, you might not even get through the whole round because your battery might drain using the GPS and the app in tandem. This, with ShotScope, what I love so much about it is that it takes all those things out of the equation. Instead, you get a GPS watch that has all of the tracking on it as well. So not only are you using the GPS watch to tell you distances to front, middle, and back of every hole, and you can take a look at other things, other distances that it measures, that's the device that's tracking when you're hitting a shot, along with the sensors that screw into your golf clubs. It works out brilliantly because it's something you might use anyway. You might use a GPS watch anyhow, and even if you don't, it's not that big of a deal to have that on your wrist because people play with watches and things like that all the time. And it works worldwide. There's no subscription format to it, so that has kind of been a turnoff for a lot of people who are paying, you know, $100 a year or more for that in another service or another platform. And there's no tagging. It figures out which club you're using based on the sensor that it reads. And then it maps it and it gives you all that performance tracking data that you would expect in terms of strokes gained, your tendencies, how far you actually hit your clubs. And it gives you data that you can use to improve. So we're going to work with them throughout the entire year. I'm going to be using ShotScope when I play golf, so you can see how I play. And I can kind of dig through some of the data with you, and I'm going to kind of analyze my path to better, because in the last couple of years, I have really gotten away from playing focused good golf. I just play when I can and then not think about it, and I want to be good again. I really enjoyed playing the Myrtle Beach World Am last year. I enjoyed competing, and I was ill-prepared to do it, and so I want to put myself in a position when, if I do decide to try to compete this year in a couple of tournaments, hell, maybe try a US Am qualifier. I know about my game, and I can tell because of ShotScope what I need to do, how to approach a golf course, how to be able to take a round and build one up and put a good number on the card and be successful when I play competitive golf. So we're working with ShotScope this year, so more on that to come in the coming weeks. And then, of course, we continue to work with our friends at AutoSlash for a couple more episodes. We've talked about them in the past. We have so much travel that we do, especially now with Golf Trip X coming along. I've got a bunch of things I've done the last few weeks. I've got more to come. And I almost always rent a car when I travel because I usually fly to a destination and then I got to get going right away. And it can be a real pain in the neck to figure out what the best rate is, who's got it, what type of car, all that stuff. And so with AutoSlash, that's all been able to change. You can go to autoslash.com and try this for yourself. And what you do is you go to AutoSlash, you tell AutoSlash where you're going, as in where you're picking up from, the date you need the car, when you're going to return it, and AutoSlash is going to go looking for you to find the absolute best rate possible. And on top of finding the best rate possible, they're going to ask you whether you're a member of AAA or Costco or other organizations that give you a special discount for membership on car rental service. They'll look that up for you. So they're going to find you the absolute best deal for you with all of your memberships, with all the coupon codes, everything that's available, public and private, to get you the best deal. They're going to email that data to you, then you're going to pick the lowest rate possible, and you're going to set up your booking. And then AutoSlash is going to continue to look and look and look and look up until the very second you pick up your car to see if you are going to get a better deal with someone else or even the same provider. You can unbook and rebook constantly without penalty, and you can have the absolute best deal and know when you get to the counter when you pick up your car, you're going to have the best deal in your hands. And if you're someone who likes to pay in advance for your car rentals, they have AutoSlash deals as well where you can pay and still get a refund with 48 hours of advance cancellation. So you could still save a lot of money by paying up front, which a lot of travel companies will let you do that and save money, but very few of them will actually let you get that money back. Most of that stuff is non-refundable. You are locked in and screwed if your plans change. So check out AutoSlash, their slash deals. Check out AutoSlash.com if you want to do kind of book at the counter type rentals. Either way, they're going to save you a lot of money. So check it out for yourself at AutoSlash.com. All right, we're going to do a little extended edition of the podcast. I know a lot of personal stuff in the first half of the show. But I did want to talk about Rory McIlroy and what a wonderful Sunday it was at the Players' Championship. I know we don't have to talk about whether it's a major or not. I really don't care. It's close enough for me. You don't have to call it a major, but it's one of the best tournaments of the year. And I think it was much better in March this time, obviously because of the leaderboard that we got. But I like TPC Sawgrass more in March. I know that the rye oversee that makes it look absolutely emerald green, finishing on St. Patrick's Day, that might be expected, but with that green look, so much different than when you got May when it was firm and fast and often dry. I know that was controversial for some people, and I know in agronomy circles you kind of go, well, you know, brown's better. We want people to think brown is better. We don't want the Augustification of golf to kind of creep even further than it already has. We're trying to create this revolution in playable golf courses that don't necessarily look like Augusta National because not everyone's got that budget and water and fertilizer and all those things are very expensive, in some cases bad for the environment. So they don't want to encourage that. But the course looked beautiful. The fairways looked wider. They brought some of the pine straw back into play that maybe they kind of gotten away from in recent years where they were growing rough to try to catch it instead of putting in the pine straw. Well, with a softer golf course, you can have rough that's a little bit lower, and those big misses are going to get penalized because they're big misses. But if you have a small miss, you know, it's a little bit different. You can kind of handle it a little bit differently. So I think the course setup was great. The small rough, I think they will probably change that for next year, make it a tad bit deeper. I think they wanted to give these guys a little bit of room to play, and they wanted to see what it would look like for the top players to have driver in their hand and play along this golf course a little bit more as it was intended to be played by when it was designed by Pete and Alice Dye, the way that they wanted it. They wanted to put driver in hands. They wanted mid-irons into par fours, and they wanted long shots into par fives, 16 aside, of course. And so I think this is more like what the design called for. I mean, it's not exactly the same, don't get me wrong, but I think you're getting more of what the stadium course was supposed to be in this form of it. And you got a great leaderboard, and you had world-class players all up and down it. And still, even though being able to hit driver, and frankly being forced to hit driver, honestly created an advantage for some players. I think about Rory, obviously. I think about Dustin Johnson, John Rahm, whose strength is driving the golf ball. Those guys had a big advantage, and yet still, if you looked kind of up and down the top 10, top 20 contenders, at the end of the day, it was a pretty even split of guys who hit the ball a long way and guys who don't hit it as long. So even a good ball striker who isn't necessarily the longest player in the world was still able to compete. And literally the last guy in the field, Jim Furyk, who got in based on a T9 finish at Honda. I mean, that's what got him in. And he got in as the last guy in the field, and he puts up an incredible weekend, gets himself into position to nearly win the golf tournament when he's basically been doing nothing since recovering from being the Ryder Cup captain, putting a start together here or there, but a lot of sponsor exemptions because when you're the Ryder Cup captain, other than PGA of America events and the spots here and there where you can kind of get in the field, you're basically giving up your career for a year plus so that you can put things together, you can do logistics. You're not worried about your personal career because typically you're at that stage where it's kind of over. And Jim Furyk kind of gave up his career and a lot of opportunities to play golf so that he could be the Ryder Cup captain. And when he has played, especially in the fall, he played pretty okay in a few events, and obviously played okay at Honda to get a T9. Now he's got second. All of a sudden, with a second place finish of the players, he went from what, like 110th in the world to 58th. So now he's in the WGC match play all of a sudden. If he moves up another 8 spots in the world ranking, he's going to get in to the Masters all of a sudden. So he could set up an incredible year because of this week. And that's in part because this golf course allows all kinds of types of players to succeed. I love the way Rory played on Sunday. I don't think that it necessarily dismisses the idea that he's not a good closer. I think that, I said this on Twitter earlier to somebody, we have this idea of Rory McIlroy as this stone cold killer, that because when he won early in his career, when he won his first two majors, he won the 2011 US Open, he won the 2012 PGA, he won them by laugher margins, 8 shots, and he made everyone look horrible in the process, that we just figured, like, that's how he wins all the time. But that's not how he wins. In fact, most of Rory McIlroy's wins are squeakers. They're not easy. They're hard. And he is not a great closer. He's someone that really struggles with the idea of closing, that he deserves to win. He struggles with that. And he talked about it on Sunday after the fact, that the hardest part for him of getting this done on the back nine was convincing himself, why not me? Now, we sit here, and I read that quote, and I think, you're Rory freaking McIlroy, as J.P. Fitzgerald once said, his ex-caddy. You're Rory freaking McIlroy. What are you doing? Like, you are a four-time major champion. You are an incredible player. You're one of the best players to ever play golf. What do you mean you have self-doubt? What do you mean you don't think you can close? And maybe some of that has piled up because he gets so close so frequently. And that's the knock on him, is he gets there all the time. He gets to the final group and doesn't win. Well, it's basically a 50-50 prospect if you get into the final group and win. So if you multiply that outcome by all the times he's been in the final group in the last couple of years, which is 9, then you have basically a 50-50 chance, so 1 out of 2, and you multiply that, 1 out of 2, 1 out of 2, so 0.5, 0.5, 0.5. A lot of times, you're not expecting to win a whole, you aren't going to win all of those, of course, but they pile up over time, and you're expecting to lose. And for him, because he gets there so often, it probably makes it worse, honestly, than someone who just kind of stalks, occasionally gets into the spot, is like, yeah, I've done it, I'm going to win, and it's over. Think about Martin Trainer, the guy who won Puerto Rico. He has 3 wins between the Web.com Tour and the PGA Tour in, like, the last year. And when he gets in a position to win, he wins, but otherwise, he stinks. It's like T60, T64, miscut, 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 miscut. But when he gets there, he knows his record's pretty much perfect. So he finishes it off. Rory's just the opposite. He gets into position, he's like, I've been here like 50 times, and I've only closed at 15. To him, that sounds horrible, but it's still incredible. And I think for him, he's got to be able to turn that around into a positive. He's tried to do that so far this year, and obviously now successful. He wasn't blistering great on Sunday, but he was good enough in really bad conditions to hold off the challengers. And the guys in the final group, Tommy Fleetwood and the 54-hole leader, John Rahm, never got it going. They had bad juju between them. Rahm got hot pretty quick. He wasn't playing great, but he was hanging around. And then he gets to 11, par 5. He's in a bunker. He's thinking, I'm going to hit a 220-yard shot with an 8-iron, curl it with a draw against the wind, over water to a par 5 green, and his caddy's like, you've got to be kidding me. Like, this is the dumbest thing ever. Basically trying to politely tell him, you're trying to make 6 now then. And Rahm decides, nope, I'm going to do it. And sure enough, he puts in the water, and that's pretty much it. Rahm shot 76 on Sunday. He was a dud. And part of that is because he makes bad decisions when he plays, and hopefully that will improve with time. Hopefully he gets better at it, but also he gets so down on himself. He can't just kind of steady the ship. He's either all in or all out. And the best players really can't do that. The best players know there are going to be bad shots, and they try to mitigate their mistakes by making good decisions. So you can't hit bad shots and make bad decisions. That doesn't work. You could hit bad shots and make good decisions. You can make good decisions and hit bad shots. Probably not going to work out. But you can get yourself steered in the right direction with good thoughts, good thinking, good strategy. And John Rahm just wasn't doing it. And then he gets a 17, puts it in the drink, it's over, looks bad. And so for him, I think the goal moving forward is not, we talk about his temper all the time, he has temper tantrums, all that stuff. You could still get upset. It's okay to get upset. I don't have any problem with him getting upset. I mean, he might look childish when he like stomps clubs and huffs and puffs and stuff. It's okay to get upset. But you need to be able to balance yourself out. You need to be able to go back to the middle pretty quickly. And he can't do that. So that's his big knock. Tommy Fleetwood just didn't have it on Sunday. I think he just probably was pretty nervous about the position he was in and just, frankly, just didn't have it. And that happens. That's okay. He's going to be a guy who's going to get his major someday. I really do think that. He could do it at the Masters. He could do it at the U.S. Open. He's been a U.S. Open specialist the last couple of years. I know Brooks Koepka has been. Dustin Johnson obviously is. Tommy Fleetwood's in that conversation, too. Xander Schauffele, for that matter. So I think we're going to really look to him at Pebble in June. You have to love his chances. He's playing really good golf, just not closing the deal. And that's Rory, except Rory had 14 PGA Tour wins coming into this, and Tommy Fleetwood was still looking for his first and doesn't have a ton of European Tour wins to build up that pressure. So really interesting to see that. And then it was kind of cool to see a bunch of other guys kind of get in the mix. Johnny Vegas got close. Can you imagine what the difference would have been if he had made his, what, like 5 or 6 foot birdie putt on 18 to get to 15 under? Maybe things are a little bit different. His putt on 17, though, from what, 70 feet, 69 feet, 7 inches, I think it was, to make birdie to get himself to 14 in the first place was, oh, just the most beautiful thing. And that came after Eddie Pepperell. It's what he describes as a fairly easy putt, but a double breaker off a mound. It's a 50-footer to get him to 14 under. I mean, it was just such great golf. So much stuff happening. That's what I really like about the players is if you think about Augusta National, if you think about all the places where movement happens at the Masters, and the saying is always, you know, the back nine is on Sunday when the Masters starts. But think about the places where guys make moves. You get to 10 and 11, which are not birdie holes. I mean, disaster can happen, but more often than not, if you're in trouble, you're going to just play for 5. 12, obviously, you can make anywhere from 2 to 10. And then 13, 14, 15, 16 are really where you can kind of make your run. But 17 is not easy with the way the green pitches. And 18 is definitely not easy as a 460-yard uphill par 4 to close. So it's really hard to make a big, big move on all of those holes. It doesn't feel that way at Sawgrass. 10, you can birdie. It's relatively short. 11, you should birdie. It's a par 5, but you can eagle. 12, you should birdie. I think they've still got to work out the kinks on what 12 should be as a drivable par 4, but you can birdie your eagle. 13, with where they put the pins, particularly on the weekends, their feeder shots, so you can birdie. 14's hard, but 15's not. 16's an eagle lap. 17, you can make it 2 if you just hit a straightforward shot, and then 18 is actually pretty difficult. But you can score a little bit better, I think, on the back nine at Sawgrass than you can do so at the Masters. When you do it at the Masters, you're a legend, but there's a lot more room for volatility at Sawgrass, which I think makes it a great tournament. And you can go eagle, birdie, birdie, and win, or you can go par, double, double, and ruin the whole thing. I mean, there are just a lot of different ways that finish can go, and that brought in so many different players into the tournament. It's not, again, not a major, not trying to advocate it for one, but it's a damn good golf tournament, and it deserves to be in March. This golf course plays appropriately in March. I think they'll ramp up the speed a little bit next year. I think they will ramp up a little bit on the rough for next year. They're going to try and make it firmer and faster. They had a little bit of rain to deal with, and it was just kind of cool, so you couldn't make it really all that firm and fast. But if it gets a little bit warmer, then you're going to see a Players Championship that's probably about its absolute best. So kudos to the PGA Tour for putting on a really good event. I know that there's critiques of the other changes they made, the new trophy. Some people don't like it. Some people do. easy to make fun of. The music, actually, I kind of like. I like the change. I thought it was pretty cool. The broadcast, I thought, something I want to mention real quick. The broadcast was really good. I know that people tend to have a problem watching PGA Tour on TV because there are so many commercial breaks. Fortunately, with this, there's limited commercial interruption, and it felt like it was handled like a major. I know they tried to kind of dance around it a lot because they can't say it is. There's no official majors, but they're treated that, you know, they can't elevate their own tournament to major status. But they don't have to do that. It just is what it is. It's really good, and everyone knows it. And you don't have to call it what it is or what it isn't, because the majors don't call it what it is and what it isn't. So just let it be what it is. But the coverage of the event was really good. The graphics packages were interesting. They implemented a lot of the stuff that Fox has done really well, and it looked good. It's just done right. And I'm very happy that this tournament came off well. I'm very interested and more doubtful about how the PGA Championship will look in May, especially given the number of Northeast venues and cold weather venues they're going to have for about a decade. I'm very curious how that's going to look in May, more than I'm curious how the players are going to look in March. So that's really, I think, the proof in the pudding of making all these schedule changes is how does the PGA look in May. But before we get to them, we get into the Masters. We have so much great hype. We've got Rory playing great. We've got Dustin playing great. JT's playing pretty well. You've got Bryson DeChambeau. You've got Brooks Koepka trying to figure something out. You've got Tiger Woods, who's gaining strokes like crazy, having a great year gaining strokes, but he just can't seem to get out of the top 15. All kinds of cool stuff. Phil won. You got so much stuff going on in golf right now. It should be a great, 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 great Masters, and we're less than a month away. It's so exciting. We're less than 3 weeks away from crowning a Masters champion. So very excited to see all of that. So that's going to do it for us this week on the show. Next week, hopefully, we can kind of get back into this. We'll talk a little bit about the WGC match play. We'll talk about what happened to the Valspar Championship, which has a pretty good field. Some WDs today on Monday, but pretty good field overall. So we wrap up the Florida swing this week, then get into the official pre-Masters prep with the WGC match play and the Valero Texas Open, which in and of itself should be an interesting story. We get to the Masters, and all of a sudden, a month later, we've got the PGA, and we're going, man. This is golf season. Get ready for it. We're here. You can get a hold of me on Twitter, at Ryan Ballingy. You can email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. If you listen to us through iTunes and through the podcast app, please give us a 5-star ranking. Helps us reach more people. And that's about it for us from here. So for everybody at Golf News Net, I'm Ryan Ballingy saying thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next time on the 19th Hole Golf Show.